Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from April 15, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on dispassion and developing freedom from the demands of craving and desire. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossovermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is called Dispassion, Freedom from Desire. Let me just read it. Dispassion, freedom from desire is a Dhamma article on the Buddha's teaching that conditioned states of mind have definite and direct causes. And that really is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. What we think is, and how we think about our relationship to the external world is going to determine how we experience the world. This is often referred to as the law of conditionality, or the law of if this occurs, then that results. And that directly relates to dependent origination, which again says the same thing. If we have a mind that's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the true nature of life in the phenomenal world, then the result is going to be something based on that ignorance, which is usually stressful, disappointing in some way, unsatisfactory, all the way up to extreme physical and emotional suffering. The Buddha's words, and what is the noble method that is rightly seen and understood by discernment? From the arising of this comes the arising of that. In other words, from the arising of ignorance through 12 observable causative links comes all manner of suffering. When this isn't, that isn't. When there is no longer any ignorance of Four Noble Truths, suffering ceases. Pretty simple and direct. When you, or at least when I look at it this way, but with the broader understanding that I have of what the Buddha taught, it's very simple and very, very direct. If I want to develop a life of lasting peace and happiness, what the Buddha's teaching is to end ignorance of the nature of life in the phenomenal world. Very simple and very direct, and he taught a way of doing that, again, from the Buddha's words. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. This is the noble method that is rightly seen and rightly ferreted out by discernment. When a mind is aflame with passion, suffering ensues. Stillness in the present moment experience of a mind settled in equanimity. Stillness is the present moment experience of a mind settled in equanimity. Stillness is a condition of mind developed through understanding the Four Noble Truths. Equanimity is a state of mind free of reaction, without movement caused by passion. All things in the phenomenal world have causes arising in the phenomenal world. When the mind is settled in dispassionate mindfulness, the agitation of clinging and desire are abandoned. It is the nature of conditioned mind to grasp. When thoughts become agitated by passion, grasping arises. Grasping and the ensuing clinging is the cause of stress and suffering known as dukkha. Is that clear? I think you all heard me talk about this over and over again. And grasping, craving, clinging, it all comes out of a self-referential view of life. In other words, I have these needs that in the moment are not being met, and that's an ongoing process. And so each and every moment we're distracted by fulfilling the needs of an ego self rather than simply resting in a calm and peaceful mind in complete acceptance of what's occurring. Is that clear? Dukkha arises from all forms of grasping, desire, craving, greed, and aversion. All arise from ignorance or a lack of wisdom. Ultimately, all created things arise from desire or passion, and all created things are put aside through dispassion. Dispassion arising from wisdom is the condition of an awakened mind. When passion ceases, cessation of suffering arises. So this is where we can get caught up in semantics and using, isn't passion good, and doesn't passion help motivate me? And in a certain sense, it does. And in that sense, it's good to have passion for awakening. There's a word for that called chanda, a Pali word, C-H-A-N-D-A, which means skillful desire or skillful passion. What the Buddha is referring to and what I'm referring to is a passion that is very subtle, but based on self-referential views and always seeking to continue to establish this self-referential view of self, this view of self that is rooted in ignorance. And that is a very, very strong passion to recognize, and even more difficult to abandon it. The Buddha's third sermon that he ever gave, one of the cardinal discourses, called the Fire Discourse, or attachments to passion. This is one of the discourses, or one of the talks that I'll give on retreat also. And that directly relates to recognizing and abandoning passions that are rooted in ignorance. And that is the, that is really the root cause of all the difficulties that we have in the world. And I know that sounds like a pretty, maybe almost ridiculous statement, all the difficulties in the world. But if you think about from minor disagreements between people to major disagreements between nations, it all comes down to that passion for establishing a self. And you know, I don't like to use politics and worldly conditions, but right now I think it's a good example of that. And again, not to take sides, because there's always different views, but the passions that are coming out of North Korea for that individual to establish himself in some way is colliding with other passions to establish other things in the world. And again, I'm not taking sides about what's right or wrong here. I think it's pretty obvious. But it's all rooted in passion. It's all rooted in the desire to establish a certain point of view. Sometimes that point of view is correct in a political sense. But in a Dhamma sense, it all comes down to trying to establish something from an individual view, or that individual view through its associations has created a group view that is now being put forth. Again, no moral judgments there in this talk. It's not what I'm talking about. Ultimately, all created things arise from desire or passion. And all created things are put aside through dispassion. And again, using these words, it can go from... I always use chocolate cake. I can't wait to get another piece of chocolate cake. I got to get another piece of chocolate cake. Where can I get it the quickest? Where's the closest bakery? Where's the quickest ShopRite? That's passion. Dispassion is, wait a minute, I don't need chocolate cake. And as soon as I have that thought and let go of the need for chocolate cake, my mind is at peace. And I'm using a very simplistic example, but that's true about anything that we can generate in our minds that are creating a disturbance. And in this way, this is what feelings are related to when the Buddha is talking about feelings. Any disturbance in the mind is a feeling. And any time we can recognize that we are agitated about something, we know that we're trying to establish a self-referential view in this situation rather than simple acceptance of what's occurring. This passion arising from wisdom is a condition of an awakened mind. When passion ceases, cessation of suffering ceases. Passion arises from attaching a thought to a feeling, creating an emotion. Passion is the action, the movement, the physical, mental, or combined, arising from that emotion. An experience provides pleasure or fulfillment in some manner, and instead of simply and dispassionately experiencing the feeling, we decide we want more of the pleasure-providing experience. Passion also arises from an experience that is perceived as unpleasant or unfulfilling, and we decide that we do not want to have that experience again. Of course, that completely contradicts the Buddha's first noble truth, that dukkha is going to occur simply as a consequence of having a human life. If we continually base a life on avoiding anything that is unsatisfactory, we're always going to be chasing something that we can't achieve. Again, that's a product of discursive thinking. Every discriminating judgment of an experience, whether the judgment is positive or negative, creates more desire or more aversion, more passion. This repetitive and discursive response to passion is the cause of conditioned thinking. This passion is not negative passion. This passion is the expression of wisdom arising from present moment mindfulness of the true nature of reality. This passion is not a mind state that can be generated through passion. This passion naturally arises through a practice of putting aside that which gives rise to passion. The Buddha's words, among whatever qualities there may be, fabricated or unfabricated, the quality of dispassion, the subduing of intoxication, the elimination of thirst, the uprooting of attachment, the interruption of discursive thinking, the destruction of craving develops dispassion, cessation, the realization of an unbinding or nibbana. This is considered supreme. Those who have confidence in the quality of dispassion have confidence in what is supreme. For those with confidence in the supreme, supreme is the result. This passion is not this detachment. This passion is deep, mindful engagement. This passion is not arrogant and irreverent aloofness. This passion is mindful and complete acceptance. This passion is not avoidance. This passion is mindfulness of whatever is occurring as events occur, free of discriminating thought. This passion is not based on in ignorance. This passion is mindful expression of true wisdom. There's a little bit more to the sutta, but I think I'm going to stop there because it makes the point. The type of mindfulness that's developed through this, through the Buddhist teachings, rooted in concentration developed in meditation, allows us to experience life free of the passion, free of the need to have it be any different than what's occurring. And when we can develop that type of mindfulness, which is developed directly through the Dhamma, the reason why I'm saying that, it's not all that difficult, and it doesn't take lifetimes to develop. It can be developed in this lifetime, rather quickly. But once that mindfulness is developed, it allows us to be fully present with our life as life occurs. And that's where lasting peace and happiness resides. That's the whole point of the Buddhist teachings, to stop being distracted by chasing after what gives us pleasure or avoiding what brings us displeasure, or even the more subtle aspects of those things that we are neutral about, and live our life as our life occurs, free of the need of it being any different than it is. That's the key to the Buddhist teachings. It's what he described when he describes dependent origination in the reverse order, from developing wisdom and eliminating those other 12 steps in the dependent origination. We're eliminating ignorance. The entire point of the Buddhist teachings. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths leads to all manner of suffering. Recognizing our contributions to dukkha through the framework of the Eightfold Path brings us liberation and peace and lasting happiness. So that's the talk for today. Any questions about the talk? And we'll just go around the room. No, we're good? Diane, good to see you this morning.
Oh, shoot, I'm first. I'm thanking you for being here.
You're welcome.
Doing this every day.
Three days a week, yeah.
I appreciate it. I am certifiable right now. I thankfully I've been through this enough times in my practice to realize that it's okay and this too shall pass. I just, my mind, it's been a wild elephant when I read that, your article. I thought, yes, that's, and I'm very thankful for that, what metaphor or analogy of the wild elephant, because I can definitely see how my mind goes. And it's, I've been up since 4:30 this morning, just the wild elephant chomping around the rope and the stake and the tree, and just it feels like my mind has been absolutely everywhere, and I've watched it, and I kept coming back to the breath, and I kept coming back to the breath, and I kept coming back to the breath for like 3 or 4 hours. And I've been through that, like I said, a few times. That one time I said it to Matt, and he said, "Oh, that's great. That's right where you should be." And I thought, "Oh, it's just part of the process." I think that the feeling like I'm crazy, and then when this passes, it's like there's some kind of deeper peace that comes. And I just reading the article, that's what triggered it all. I'll blame it on you. was the dispassion. And what kept running around my mind all morning was, what are you doing with your life? What are you supposed to do? What were you born to do? It was like a nagging kind of thing, and I kept saying, "Hey, that's ego. Leave me alone. You know, go back in your cage." And but it just—I mean—that was what was thrashing the elephant, or you know, anyway. for me, meditation has, you know, literally changed my life, and it's not an easy thing to go through these phases, or I don't know what you'd call them, and I don't know of a sutra, sutra that's on them or anything like that, but it's, I know the peace that comes after I've gone through one of these storms is just worth being gentle with myself while it's happening, and just kind of ride it out, and you know, this is, it's impermanent. You look like you want to say something.
No, I'm listening.
Ghosts. Come. I guess that's all. I'm just grateful for the practice, and right now I'm still a little crazy, but that's
okay. Thank you. One of the things that you're saying is you're recognizing and a less than peaceful mind state. Your words are that I'm crazy. Your thoughts are disturbing. But you also have the ability to see, you have the framework to see that there's another way of being, because you've experienced a calm and peaceful mind. You're not just stuck in that one singular view that, you know, my mind is a mess or I'm just a mess. It's just a quality of mind. And you have integrated the Eightfold Path to the extent that you're able to see that. And that's the beginning or the foundation of profound change. And the impermanent, recognizing the impermanent nature of your thoughts is so important too, that this is just something that is occurring right now. It doesn't define who I am. You mentioned something why am I here? What's the purpose? So even the Dalai Lama said the purpose of time is to awaken, which means the reason why we're here, the most important thing that we can do is to awaken. We all have positions in life, we have things to do, we have things that we'd like to accomplish. But the overarching theme of our life when we develop the Eightfold Path is to awaken. And like the Buddha often says, when we take to that task as if our hair's on fire, that's a phrase that he often used, doesn't apply to me anymore, then we have the right focus. We all have things that we have to do in life. And there, especially if we're not living in a cave or in a monastery setting or involved in life, it's even more difficult to fit this in. But again, that's where the framework of the Dhamma, that's where right effort guides us. And when we have moments like this, when things occur in our life that get us thinking crazy, we can take true refuge, just like you described, and come back to the Dhamma, come back to our breath, develop a calm and peaceful quality of mind as best as we can. And it might not be the quality of mind that we hope to have, but we recognize that we can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, which is exactly what you described. You know, this is just what's occurring right now. And that's so important. That's an aspect of being gentle with ourselves.
Sometimes when I read that, it sounds like it's going to just be for a moment that I'll have a less than peaceful mind state. And when it, you know, when it wakes me up at, it was around 4:39, I think it was, I just was wide awake. And I think part, and I'm not trying to analyze it, what the when you talk about the quality of my mind, what went through my mind was not the usual, that seems to have attended my mind for most of my life. It was different, of a different complexion and color and lights and stuff. And I'm thinking, or the thoughts comes to me now, I'm seeing progress in the people, the clients that I work with, but it is so small that I'm sure I feel like I'm the only one that can see it. So I think ego, or it seems to me the ego is saying to me, do something where you can definitely see progress, you know, create something that's visible. And it's hard to work with people the way I do, or the way I'm guided, or something like that, and just let it happen, just let it be. I mean, not have anybody say, oh, look at that. You know what I mean? It's not a tangible, productive, you know, production kind of a thing. And I feel like ego was after me, or, you know, gnawing at me, saying, do something that you can see. Then you'll feel better about yourself.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense. It does. A self-referential ego self wants something to reference that, yes, I'm good, I'm doing something. But there's another side of that that is non-self-referential. And it's simply, is your way of being in the world effective? And where that comes from is, after the Buddha awakened, he sat for another 2 weeks considering, is there a way to be effective in the world, meaning teach this Dhamma? And it wasn't until he decided how to do that he entered the world again, in a literal and figurative sense, and began teaching, began offering his services to others. So, as we develop a clear understanding of who we are in relation to the world, that ego-driven view of I need to prove that I'm being effective is then guided by the simple understanding that I'm living in an effective life in the framework of the Eightfold Path. Again, we can bring the Eightfold Path is not something just for a so-called spiritual practice. It's the framework for our entire life. So if we're considering using right speech, action, and livelihood, you know, right livelihood is there for a reason, then we have to acknowledge that, yes, I'm engaged in right livelihood. Part of right livelihood is that it's helpful, that we're doing something that's helpful towards others. And that can be anything. I mean, it could be you can be working in a copy center, but what you're doing is providing a service. And if you look at it that way, it's not, well, I'm just working in a copy center. I'm interacting with other human beings, and I should be loving and compassionate and present with everyone. And I know that you do that in the work that you do. So those subtle little things that maybe other people aren't noticing, it's at least important that you understand that what you're doing is having a real contribution. Not to blow yourself up, but just to give you guidance. When I first started teaching meditation, I had a pretty well-developed Dhamma practice, but it was mostly on my own. And when I started sitting in front of people and teaching, I then had the thought that if I'm going to teach this, I better teach something that's useful and not contributing to people's confusion. And then I really started looking at how the Buddha taught, and that helped guide me. So it's important to me to know that people are gaining benefit, whether it's just one person in this room or a larger group or online and all the rest of it. If what I'm saying is leading to people's confusion, then I don't want to do it. And if it's not having some helpful benefit, why go through this? You know? So the feedback that I get from people is important too, that I know that I'm doing something that's worthwhile. Thank you for bringing that up. Taming the Wild Elephant, Diane referenced it. There's a story that the Buddha taught about how meditation works, and he used the metaphor of taming a wild elephant. And when you have a wild elephant, it is just that. And if you try to control it, that elephant's going to be flapping its ears and stomping the ground and getting all aggravated. So you take the elephant, you tie it to a strong post, and it gets worse and worse and worse because it can't keep doing all the things that it just wants to do wildly. But eventually, the elephant will settle down, and then it becomes useful for you as a tool, as an animal that can drag your stuff around or give you rides. Meditation is like that. When we first sit down, our mind is like that wild elephant thrashing around. I can't sit quietly. But we use the breath as the rope and the post as mindfulness, if you think about that metaphor. And eventually, our minds start quieting down. And then we develop, much like the elephant develops into a useful animal, our minds develop a useful way of engaging in the Dhamma, because it's now well concentrated and controlled. So thank you for bringing that up too. That's an important teaching. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
tag on that, and this sort of that if you don't have a passion, it allows you to see everything. A passion is a driver. It's a narrowing of your thinking. You know, I have a passion for chocolate cake, or I have a passion for red cars. You know, and I don't see all the other blue cars and the white cars and the green cars. Great cars. I think that's sort of what the Buddha is sort of trying to teach, that a passion is a narrowing of your vision.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you don't have a passion, or your passion is, you're not driven by a passion, you see all the cars, you know, blue ones and green ones and whatever. I think that's sort of really what it's sort of driving at, but you still might choose a red car at the end of the day if you were buying one, but you haven't a narrowing of vision to get to that decision. That's what I get. I haven't actually heard of anybody speak of this, and I don't, so this might be peculiar to my mind. I don't know. Oh, another thing is that holding. My mind is, I'm beginning to learn my mind, and when I think, if I'm not actually on my breath, my mind is on a story. You know, it seems to be not a middle place where I can not be engaged in my breath and not have a story going on in my mind. It's, so really, for me to be mindful in the Dharma sense, I really need to be thinking about my breath and holding that concentration.
Yeah.
Is very tiring to hold that concentration. You know, minute by minute, hour by hour, it's very tiring. So I think I've sort of learned to be very forgiving with myself, and when I come off my breath and go on to a story and go on to passion, you know, just accept that that's going to happen and get back to my breath. But it's like doing math all day or something like that. It's a brain exercise, and it has its tiring side to it. But it has its upside, obviously. And then what I was going to say is that, I've never heard anyone speak of this, but sometimes in the morning, when you first wake up, and you find yourself laying in bed, and there's just that few moments where you're just coming out of your sleep, you're just arousing from your sleep, and then you can feel what I think is my ego kick in. You know, that you can feel it come into your head, and like, boom, it's there, then it's off and running. And I've had that for years and years and years.
Really?
Yes. However, lately, I don't have that. I wake from my sleep, and I don't have that, boom, it's kicking in.
Wow.
As I said, I've never heard anybody speak of that. If that's just peculiar to me, or how my mind works. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I've never heard it described that way, but you're...
But it's my consciousness, or my ego. You can feel it join your mind. It comes from your sleep. You haven't come out of your sleep. There's no references to stuff. And then it
you just slip into gear and your mind's off. But as I say, lately I haven't had that boom. I just sort of wake up.
You're able to maintain that much more peaceful quality of mind.
Yeah.
Looking back on my life, it's interesting to bring this up because I've never really thought about that, and I wonder if other people feel the same way. That when I wake up now, I don't feel that jolt of the days coming up and what am I going to do and where am I going and what is this day holding for me. I enter into the day in a much more peaceful way, kind of like my dog. He eases into the day. He doesn't get all excited, right? But, and I don't know why I'm thinking about this, when I was in, it feels like when I was like 25 or 30, just starting out in business, I woke up in that rush, almost a panic, like and that was a definite jolt from being asleep, and now I'm awake. And that has changed, and that's a significant. It's significant to recognize that difference, and to see what has developed. And you're also talking. You mentioned impermanence. You're talking about the impermanent quality of mind. So for many years, you had that experience of jolting awake, and now it's not there, and it's not there because your mind is more well concentrated, and it's more. It's seeing the world more from right view than wrong view. So there's no reason for that. So thank you for sharing all that.
Can I come in?
Please, Debbie.
Well, I think Mary was the one that gave a little thing about the neurobiology on the, that you put on the site. But in terms of the neurobiology, too, when you practice, when you have a practice, over time, you know, that's growing new neurons. And it is actually changing your brain. Growing the part of your brain that can be more concentrated, more focused, more peaceful. You know, so they, you know, there's Daniel Siegel and Jack Kornfield do a thing together where they talk about that, you know, a lot in their workshops, and it's just really amazing what they're learning now from brain imaging. So it's like you're retraining your brain, but you're all from the concentration, but you're also actually changing your brain by growing certain neurons that help you be in that space, you know. So it's so cool that this spiritual practice goes along with you know, things that actually literally change in your brain, you know. So that's so neat that you have that, because I think most of us wake up still. Still young in my practice to wake up with that.
Good job.
Well, it's kind of like an anxiety thing. It's like, I got it. Or it's just the realities of all this stress, all the dukkha that's in your life.
Yeah.
That's facing.
But you can
do that.
Engage.
Yes.
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 I used to be like,
I'm still engaging.
I know what you mean, because it's like it, engage is the best word I can come up with. It's even before a thought. And it comes as a boom, you know, into your mind.
Yeah.
But as I say, lately,
that's great.
I've not. I don't wake up with that jolt and press.
Yeah.
I just from waking, it just flow into, and then I flow into a thought, or I flow into
I flow into what I'm supposed to do. I just, it's like I just move. It's not a
it's like the merging almost of the, you know, the mind that's asleep into the waking mind. You know, it's like it's like the awakening happening, but it, you know, it's like merging from when you're asleep to when you're awake.
Yeah,
integration. You know, integration comes up for me.
That's a good word to use. Yeah, integration. Thanks for bringing that up, Debbie. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising that the way that we think and the type of mindfulness that we actually have wouldn't change the way that our brain functions. But it's also very interesting to find out that they're showing that it does. You know, that we have an actual physical impact by changing the way that we think and getting it more aligned with reality. Again, with how the Buddha framed this whole thing through the Eightfold Path. Seeing, instead of not recognizing our own contribution to stress and the negative effects of that, well, of course there's going to be, I mean, they've proven that maybe the biggest change in medicine in the last 20 years is recognition of the impact that stress has on our lives and our physical well-being. And so, of course, the opposite would be true. If we can diminish or completely eliminate our contributions to stress, of course they're going to have a physical benefit to us. We're going to feel better, and we're going to think better. There's going to be more neurons working correctly. Correctly is not the right way. More in support of the way that we're thinking rather than what we're doing, which is hurting ourselves through contributing to our own stress. So again, thank you for bringing that up. And Mary, thank you for that article too. Again, it's linked on the website. A lot of people click on it, so a lot of people are getting benefit from that.
It's really fascinating when you look at how the neurons change and the connection yeah. to the brain actually
changes. Yeah. And we feel that. Yeah. You know, we have a direct experience
and,
of it.
And we can shift it one way or another.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, part of the problem with human beings is that we're still living when you did have to react quickly to something dangerous, yeah. a large yeah. animal coming
fight
at you.
Or flight.
Yeah. yeah, fight or flight. And that's, you know, we've almost evolved further in civilization than we have internally.
Mm.
And so yeah. we're still
it's
reacting.
A good match.
Yeah. We're still yeah. reacting like the tiger's going to jump out and get
yes.
us.
Yeah, and so when I think that I got to have a piece of chocolate cake, my body is saying there's a tiger coming at
yeah.
me. We have the same physical response to that and all the rest of the stuff that goes on inside. So, you know, again, the Buddha recognized this 2,600 years ago. It's just remarkable. So, how's your practice going, Mary? And any questions
it's
about
it? It's going pretty well. I mean, I'm having ups and downs. I'm coming up on the anniversary of Joe's death.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to be dispassionate. I mean, because boogeyman keeps jumping out.
Yeah. And so then you are dispassionate about being passionate, meaning, you know, being.
Well, I have to recognize and say to myself, yeah, you feel this way, and just don't turn it into a snowball.
Yes.
You feel this way, and take a couple of deep breaths, and go for a walk, whatever, and this too shall pass, and it does.
Yeah. But it's one of the things that people really get, they misunderstand about the Buddhist teachings, and maybe even, well, I'll just keep it to the Buddhist teachings, is that we're supposed to be devoid of feeling. Like it's a practice of feeling nothing, and it's really just the opposite. It's a way of feeling everything at a deep, deep level, but when it's appropriate to feel. And sometimes when I teach the Eightfold Path, instead of using right and wrong, I use appropriate and inappropriate, because that's really what it is. We feel what we feel when it's appropriate to feel that. We think what we think when it's appropriate to think that. And to feel sadness over a great loss is appropriate. But like you described it, it's not appropriate to let it get away from you and start getting into, you know, judgments and fear and why and all this stuff. We understand death because it's part of life. We understand the First Noble Truth. That doesn't mean that it should be pleasant. In fact, it means just the opposite. It means we should feel whatever we're feeling at an appropriate level and an appropriate time. When the Buddha heard that his dad was dying, he didn't say, yeah, I don't know. That's, you know. He got up off his cushion. He didn't have a cushion, off his pile of leaves, and he walked 140 miles so he could be with his dad while his dad was passing. And when you read the description, he was deeply emotionally involved in that whole scene. He wasn't devoid of feeling. He was able to be fully present, you know, and that's remarkable. So thank you for sharing that, you know, and I know it's a difficult time for you. Can I ask, has your Dhamma understanding, how has it contributed to that?
Well, I mean, initially I couldn't I stopped meditating for, a month or whatever, 6 weeks or probably 8 weeks. But once I came back in meditation, I realized that doing the meditation, it helps settle me immensely.
Yeah.
And it makes me, and I'm able to, when I do have really down periods, realize it's a really down period, but keep moving forward, and it will pass, and invariably it does.
Yeah.
I just know I'm just going to be on a roller coaster, and the practice, it just helps to keep me calm. It helps me to see things clearer. I don't wake up in the morning, whereas I used to, thinking I have 10,000 things to do. First of all, I found that's counterproductive.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That when you wake up calmer, you get just as much stuff done, only you get it done in a cleaner way, and generally you accomplish more. But emotion clouds a lot of things, but I'm grateful that I have the practice so that I can tell myself, just even if I just sit down for a minute, or just stand there for a minute and just concentrate on my breathing, and bring myself back down to earth and move forward.
And isn't that remarkable? I mean, that's how it's designed.
Yeah.
And it actually works that way. To bring peace and calm where there is usually not for most people. And to understand and see the difference. And it isn't all that, I say it's a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. But it's not all that difficult to develop. And again, I think it's the most important thing we can do, in our lives. Because it allows us to be fully present with whatever is occurring and maintain some level of equanimity, or at least be at peace with less than peaceful mind states, and know that that's entirely appropriate. So again, thank you. Debbie, good to see you this morning.
You too, Jonathan, everyone. Yeah, what everyone's shared has been so helpful, too. I feel like you're right about this. This sutra seems to, what you were saying today, it seems to be really simple and direct. My life, it speaks to me in that way that, this morning, I wanted what I won and what I wanted in terms of this weekend, which was basically space, because I have a really intense job right now in terms of clients and in terms of scheduling and all that. So I'm facing a Monday that's really intense, and so I just wanted to be in the moment and have space, but that's not necessarily how it's going to work out, so I had this resistance, and so, the whole, the way I was thinking about it, and just having to, I don't know, when I was doing my meditation, I just came into a peacefulness about accepting that, what's going to be, and letting go of this passionate need to have space, and to have quiet, and that, and just felt it's kind of a calming, peaceful acceptance of I'm gonna, just being okay with what's gonna happen, what the agenda is for the weekend and Easter and all that, and not an Easter person. I just wanted to not have Easter. But somebody I love is going through a major grief needs to have that in her life. And so called me up, needs to have something. She just lost her dad. So I feel like this today helped me transition into acceptance of, reality.
Yeah.
And so that was helpful. Peace for you today. When you said that thing about the Dalai Lama and time, could you say that again?
The purpose of time is to awaken.
Right.
Which,
so that, all of a sudden, just this wave of peace came over me when you said that. So it's like, okay, I don't have to feel so challenged by my life. I can just come to this place and try to be peaceful and accepting. And it's enough. That felt really major for me.
It is.
So I'm happy that you said that. I sometimes just feel like it's just difficult. Like, like the day I'm facing on Monday, in terms of the expectation at work to get all this stuff done and what's packed into my schedule. And for me, it's not just seeing clients, it's all the paperwork, but all the, we have to do these new authorizations for state Medicaid and stuff, which I was within that day seeing clients. So having those clients in your caseload along with your people is like really stressful. And so I'm just trying to find a way to surrender to that. You know, it's that whole need to be the good employee that gets things done. And if you can't, you can't, you know? So it's like, okay. that's a really a constant kind of stress.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff that I'm struggling to come to terms with. Because I have no control of it.
No? Yeah. What you described is covered by dukkha. There's going to be dukkha in the world. There's, we don't have any control over all of that. And sometimes it's job, sometimes it's family, sometimes it's friends. It's all covered under that big beautiful umbrella of dukkha. Thank you for all that, Debbie. What you're describing is that we might not have the space we want in our situation, but we can create the space within our own minds, and that's another way of saying a calm and peaceful mind, no matter what's occurring. It's interesting how we create scenarios or expectations about how our life should be, and it almost never falls into that or follows that, and it creates stress. And it's that initial expectation or internal description of how my life needs to be in this moment or this weekend or for the next week that creates stress. So what the answer is, it's an obvious answer, but it's so difficult, is let go of the expectation. Another way of saying that is a fabrication or an assumption. But that's the difficult part, isn't it? Because it's what I've decided I need. Another self-referential view. But this is so subtle that it's hard to see that unless we have the framework. And that's where the Dhamma is. But a simple phrase like, the purpose of time is to awaken, can really get us focused on what's most important. No matter how busy my life is or what's occurring in the world or with my closest friends or family, the purpose here is to awaken, which means to see this clearly. This is all part of dukkha. It's something, again, the more I teach and the more I practice, and even the questions that I get, that first statement of the First Noble Truth, that dukkha occurs, suffering occurs, is so obvious at first, it seems, well, of course, who cares about that? But that's the heart of the problem. Dukkha occurs, and the second noble truth is, this is your contribution to that you can bring to an end by simply developing a right view, seeing things clearly. And you described that beautifully, so thank you. Great.
I was going to say, too, that who I associate with becomes very important. If I'm with other people who are goal-oriented and you know, have these expectations, you know, things and pushing. I it's exhausting.
Right.
But if I'm with people who are thinking about awakening and going with the flow, it's amazing. I get so much more done without that stress factor. And who I associate with and who my clients are, I'm choosing who. I'm trying to choose, you know, more. And I'm trying to do things about it, but it takes a while to get things to happen. But anyway,
well, that's part of dukkha too, is that dukkha happens because I have some clients in my caseload right now that are really difficult. And so I have no choice about that. Those are the people put on my schedule, and so I have to, you know, sometimes what I'm doing, I'm bringing my meditation to my session, quietly breathing and feeling that sense of peace while I'm working with someone who, you know, my history is working with trauma victims, and so now I have a couple of sex offenders on my caseload and things like that. That's kind of could rattle me or could put me not at peace. So I feel like that's the practice is helping me to kind of just breathe in and feel that internal peace while I'm working with people that it's difficult to work with.
Yeah.
And to, just acceptance.
This
is another place where I have no choice, so.
And you're describing the difference between acceptance and approval.
Right.
So, of course, we don't need to approve of a sex offender. That would be ridiculous. But we can accept it because it's simply what's occurring, and we understand the nature of even that type of extremely egregious behavior. It's still rooted in ignorance. It doesn't excuse it. But it categorizes it appropriately. We can understand where it comes from. And good for you for being able to work with, excuse the phrase, those type of people. Because they need as much help, more help than,
That's where you go.
And instead of shunning them or burying them in a hole somewhere, we do what we can.
It's almost like they're meant to be here. I'm meant to be here.
Yeah, and Diane, for bringing up associations throughout the Pali Canon, it's really surprising. And I'll probably put a series of talks tied to these suttas, where the Buddha talks about the importance of our associations, and basically what he's saying is, who and what we associate with, it's another word for clinging, by the way, who and what we associate with is going to go a long way to what we're going to experience in our life. It's so important to choose our associations wisely when we can. And there are some situations where we can. What kind of sangha are we going to be a part of? Or maybe who we go out to dinner with, who our friends are going to be, and sometimes we can't. Our job is, any job is a good example of that. Most of the time, our jobs don't allow us to pick and choose who we're going to be with. Sometimes they do. But to look at those associations and what are they creating in our life. Tuesday's talk is on the 7 factors of enlightenment. And even in that sutta, the Buddha talks about using these, choosing our associations wisely as one factor of developing the path. And it's so important to do that. And we can look at that in all areas of our life. I know years and years ago when I had to quit drinking, the first thing they told me was that you got to get rid of. They used to say that people, places, and things, you got to change all that. And that made sense, but I had such incredible resistance, especially in the beginning, because all my friends were drunks and drug addicts, and they all hung out in certain places, and I didn't want to give those things up. But as long as I associated with them, I was going to stay a drunk and drug addict. And it was so important. It seemed silly at first when they were telling me, you got to. Wow, I can hang around with anybody I want, but I couldn't. And when it was the beginning of changing my life was changing my associations in the beginning. And that's happened over life too, over the period of my life, that I've changed my associations in certain ways. Used to be in business practices too, the same thing. But we do that all the time. It's important to recognize our associations. It's one of the reasons why I say we're so fortunate what has developed here in Frenchtown, that we have the Sangha that's developed, and we can associate with people that are intent on developing the Dhamma. That really is remarkable. So, great class. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward, and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.